I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Rich Hauck. Rich, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
In case you need an introduction, Rich is one of our writers here at Countercurrents, and he has a real talent for writing viral articles. A couple of years ago, he wrote an article called The War Against Whites in Advertising, and that article is continually showing up in our top 10 and top 20 years later. In fact, I was just looking at the stats and it's back. So that is a special talent. I wish every article could be that viral. And recently he did another article, 7-Eleven Nationalism, which has been very viral. It's a very sticky, attractive, interesting meme, gets a lot of attention. And that article is back in our top 20. And we were going to just have another conversation soon anyway. And I thought we would begin, though, by following up on 7-Eleven Nationalism and then talk about some related topics. So, Rich, have you had any further interactions with people on that meme?
I've had quite a bit after I kind of reignited it on July 11th, which is, 7-Eleven Day. And there was a whole new group of people that were sort of experiencing the meme and the article and the videos associated with in the article for the first time. And it was just really a very nice outpouring of support and people. One of the nice things about doing this and being on social media and writing in the kind of the far right or dissident right is you don't feel so atomized. There's a whole bunch of people who feel the exact same way, and you can find each other through online and through these articles and videos. It was kind of almost shocked at the amount of people who had really similar childhoods or experiences early in life, or maybe, if they're older, maybe even been mid-aged when they had these nice experiences. And it was people sharing old photos of convenience stores and their stories and how their local one used to have a place to rent videos or an arcade. And even had one guy was really kind of him. He sent me a book that his neighbor wrote about his neighborhood becoming very diverse after the Fair Housing Act and through different HUD policies, and just the racial tensions. This book just documents the racial tensions that were going on. And he said a lot of these fights that would break out and scenes of muggings and robberies were not too far from, his favorite corner store growing up. So it just, I've had a lot of interaction that's all been mostly been very positive, of people kind of realizing, having this epiphany that I also had before writing the piece, that how you feel going into your local convenience store to get gas or a couple snacks is really a much better indicator of quality of life and the kind of quality of your nation than most other metrics, particularly material wealth, GDP, or anything that you might see in a mainstream report that talks about quality of life. Healthcare delivery is abstract, and it's important, but it's not something you deal with every day. Going to the gas station or the mall or the movie theater or those sort of things are things you experience every day, and they're really very telling.
Yeah. Years ago, Gordon Baum, who used to run the Council of Conservative Citizens, said to me, "You got to get it down where the chickens can get at it, Greg." And I always thought that was so hilarious. But the point that he was making is that you have to make white dispossession really, really concrete for everyone. And it's very concrete for a lot of people when you talk about things like neighborhoods they can't visit anymore, places they don't feel at home in anymore. And that's ultimately what it's all about for us. It's having a country, having a city, having a neighborhood where we feel at home. And one of the things that modernity and liberalism has really done is it's abandoned the idea of a common space, the common good, a common home. And basically the attitude is, well, you don't like what's happening in your streets? You don't like people crapping in the park? Well, too bad. You can just stay home and watch something on TV. right? You don't have to feel at home in the public. That's all private. Everything should be private. And it's a ridiculous reduction of community life. You want to be able to feel at home on your street, in your neighborhood, in your town, in your country. That's part of what having a home means. That's part of having a good life. And this liberal attitude that, well, we can't even talk about that. You can't complain about that. It's all private. To say that it's all private is basically just saying, get used to being alienated everywhere, except if you retreat into your own home and abandon the public realm to other people.
Yeah, that is all very true. And it's even a theme I've seen among people who are otherwise pretty far right, the idea that you should just keep retreating and just, you know, get a cabin in the woods in the middle of Montana.
Yeah, you're kicking the can down the road.
That's what they're doing. So, you know, okay, you go live into your cabin in Montana, and then, you know, in 20 years there's going to be Somalians and Nigerians with Ebola in Montana too. And, you know, it's just not a proper strategy to keep running from it, to keep fleeing from suburb to suburb. And it's just kind of putting a Band-Aid on the issue, not getting at the underlying problems. I've seen that a lot. And just the escapism, whether it's in a minimal way of just playing video games at home by yourself and only talking to people via your headset, or moving to the next suburb, or trying to find the next widest market or the next furthest place out in the country. It's not a sustainable strategy for very long.
Yeah. One of the things that you are talking about with me and you're going to be writing about is a sort of extension of the 7-Eleven nationalism theme, which is the mall rat nationalism theme. And I grew up in a rural area outside of a small town. I did not grow up anywhere near a mall. And so for me, malls were always just a kind of urban or suburban thing that were very, very foreign to my experience. And I probably had some pretty snobby attitudes about malls later on, because I went sort of from living in the country to being a stuck-up urbanite. And but for a lot of people, a mall is the public square. And I was so fascinated when you brought this topic up, and I really wanted to explore this more. So can you explain a little bit about mall rat nationalism? Because that's going to be your next viral meme.
First of all, I'm like a little background. I'm an unrepentant mall rat. I was born a mall rat, die a mall rat, probably going to keel over at 80 years old with my New Balance, white New Balances on, doing laps around the mall like that. I'm just always have been a mall rat. I loved going to the malls as a kid with my parents. When I got my license at 16, one of the very first places I drove me and my childhood friend, you know, finally at the age you could drive, one of the very first places we went alone without any adult supervision driving was to the mall. I just spend a lot of time at the malls. I take my homework to the malls. I've written Countercurrents articles at malls. When I had a little more free time than I do now, I'd go to the theater really often. I would eat at the malls a lot. Just the quintessential mall rat. I still don't really like shopping online. I'd prefer anything I need to getting from the mall. And it was sort of just a place that was a background to my childhood and adolescence, and even, you know, now early adult life. I've gone on a lot of dates, met girlfriends at the malls, first dates at the malls, just, you know, everything sort of revolved around a couple of malls that I grew up around, and they were very, it was just like this common backdrop, and there was a lot of fond memories from the malls. But I also noticed that they changed a lot, and it's deterred a lot of people that I know. There's a mall where it's very nice. It has a nice plan, and they had a lot of top-notch city planners involved in this kind of indoor/outdoor mall. Has a lot of classic architecture, at least architecture motifs throughout. A lot of nice restaurants, a lot of novel restaurants too, that there was a couple that were essentially created for this new mall. There's some interesting stories behind. One of them was one of the main developers of one mall I'm thinking of ate at this restaurant, this kind of classic Italian white tablecloth restaurant for many years that's been in our town. And the woman who owned the restaurant, her kids then developed a new restaurant in conjunction with this real estate developer to come up with some new concepts. He didn't just want the typical chain stores in this new mall. So, you know, there's kind of some history there and that is around the town where I grew up. And it's just, you know, very cool. But I noticed people that are a little older than me or women, they are afraid to go to any malls, this one, any of them really, at nighttime. There's been some increasing amount of crime. They had to increase the number of security guards. The one mall I'm thinking of in particular had a period where, had the mall management not really been on top of it, it probably would have gone out of business like some of the other ones did around the city. And it was just an increase in diversity that caused it. You'd have basically gangs of young black kids roving around, and they would get in fights. I've seen a couple fights in the food court myself. There's been a couple shootings. There's been muggings around Christmas time, a couple rapes in parking garages. Just really horrific crimes in a place that's otherwise very nice. And I kind of got to thinking about how this is just like everything else, just like the 7-Eleven, just like, you know, your neighborhoods, and that your experience at the mall is kind of indicative of your quality of life. And it used to be when I, you know, not even all that long ago, maybe 10 years ago, I think, was the first time I saw a Muslim woman like in a full hijab with the headgear on and everything. And I was like, whoa, this is really foreign. And now when I go, I see dozens of them. And it, you know, this has coincided with kind of the immigration policy of the country and also my state, where a lot of these Somalis are being resettled. And the experience has changed. You know, it used to be much more white people. I would see more white people my age. Now a lot of the young people are very foreign and alien looking to me. They have different manners than we do. I get people will, you know, bump into me or cut in front of me and not say excuse me. Or they probably don't even know how to say excuse me in English, you know, is a lot of it. And the whole experience is just more frustrating and not as it's not as pleasant. You know, if you, you know, it used to be, maybe you might get cut off by a cute girl would accidentally run into you. And that was a lot better experience than being run into or shouldered by a Somali woman with a headdress on with like seven kids and giving you a dirty look as a result. It's just every, so even the little things, even someone accidentally running into you on the stairs is a different experience with an alien people. So that's kind of the, kind of going to talk about that, the increase in security that I've noticed over the years. It used to be you could, in most of these stores, you could just go try something on, and now you have to get an associate to open the door at the dressing room for you. Every little item of clothing now has a security tag on it that didn't used to have. There's more. I've noticed more security cameras up and around. Like I said, there's a much heavier presence of security guard and police. And I even found an interesting study I'm going to write in the article. I want to include this study in the upcoming article about the increased rates of security guards. And then I went and did my own research and found that all these cities that had higher rates of security guards in other cities happened to be the most diverse, of course. So there's going to be a lot of just kind of that kind of talk and about the mall experience. Same thing if in the movies, in the arcades that used to be in the malls, in some cases still are. You know, the movie theater now, every time that I experience somebody being loud and rude and on their phone and talking during the whole movie, they're not white people. That's, you know, another thing that as places get more diverse, you have to deal with different cultures that are foreign from our own. And in other cultures, they might think it's normal to talk loudly and be on their phone during the entire movie. But for us, it's frustrating and foreign.
Yeah, yeah. The problem of living in a homogeneous society is there are rude people and things like that. Yeah, people bump into you, but it's not an international incident, right? You're governed by the same sets of expectations. You can communicate with one another. You can say something to this person without fear that they're going to take it wrong or reach for a weapon or something like that. And it doesn't take many incidents like that before white people just don't want to expose themselves to it, and so they disappear. And so the Mall of America becomes the Mall of Somalia. It's happening everywhere.
Yeah, that's one of the big examples. If you look at the videos from Mall of America, you'll see more people in hijabs and headdresses than you'll see in blue jeans and T-shirts in many of the shots.
Yeah, and so, you know, what diversity is, it's just a transitional phase between a homogeneous white society and a homogeneous non-white society. It doesn't actually eventuate in a workable, diverse society. It's just a transition. And it's a transition from a society in which we feel at home to a society in which we feel absolutely not at home. It's just ethnic cleansing. Diversity always just boils down to fewer white people and fewer places where white people feel comfortable and feel at home.
Yeah, that's really all there is to it. And you'll see white people just opting out entirely, because if you're a third world person and you're in the mall and there's, you know, air conditioning and running water and your own people, it's a huge improvement. But if you're a white person and now there's, you know, a higher percentage of rude people bumping into you, not speaking your language in your own homeland, it's very different. It's not an upgrade. It's a huge downgrade. So you have people just kind of opting out entirely. One of the other things I'm going to address in the article is that I've seen some detractors on various points of it. One being that it was online shopping and video games that like kind of killed the arcade in the mall. And I really don't see that as being true for a few different reasons. I think that the malls didn't entirely exist on selling stuff anyway. They were very much a Nuevo town square where you could go be entertained and people watch and get some lunch and just meet friends and kill some time, walk around, get a little exercise, take in the sights. And I think when I first heard these ideas that it was online shopping and video games that killed the mall and the arcade, I thought, maybe there's something to that. But then I realized in a conversation with a friend of mine who's from the same area, who was kind of also in these circles of dissident thought, was pointing out that the malls that closed in our town and it would open up were always very successful when one would close in a diverse area and then open up in a very white area. White people would flock to them, and the popular malls kept moving to more and more white areas, and people would just go to them. And there was these barcades that were opening up where you could, you know, buy a beer, and all the arcades were on free play. And they're oftentimes in these sort of hipster gentrified areas and old warehouses and places like that. And I drive by them and go to them on occasion, and they're just always packed. There's a white person at every single arcade machine. And I see this and I think, you know, these places are workable. People actually do like playing arcades with their friends in public, and they do like meeting people, their friends at the mall for shopping and lunch. They just don't want to do it in a diverse area. And I had a person on Twitter that was a very like left-wing liberal person comment on a photo I had of like a nice convenience store and a mall and an arcade with all white people. And I said, this is one of the things they took from us. And the guy commented astutely, accurately, that those places still exist. You just have to be next to brown people and you don't like it. And I said, yeah, exactly. Of course. That's exactly what it is. And, you know, I'm not one of these people who will shy away from the race realism and say, oh no, it's about culture or whatever. Yeah, that's exactly. I don't want to go to arcades and malls and movie theaters with a bunch of foreign brown people. They are so alien and so different and so hostile that it ruins the experience. And I was thinking when he said that about like an early experience I had at one of these mall arcades at a friend's birthday party for a classmate or something. I think I was 9 or 10. And I was at one of these machines winning a bunch of tickets, and you could take in the tickets and get a prize or whatever. And it was just an early experience in diversity. A little black kid, probably about my age, ran up behind me when I wasn't paying attention, grabbed a big armful of all my tickets and took off running. I had to like run, leave the machine and run through the arcade trying to chase down this thief that just stole all my tickets. And I remember telling my dad about it, and he was just, you know, he was always very illiberal, and he was just like, yeah, this is how these people behave. And so when the guy made the comment that I can still go to the arcade, I just have to do it around blacks, I remember thinking back to my childhood of having seen gangs of blacks getting in fights at the arcade, loitering around machines that they weren't playing, that they would take up for hours where I couldn't go play this machine because they were just loitering there, stealing my tickets and all of this other negative things just as a child that I experienced. And I thought, yeah, you're exactly right.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with wanting to be comfortable with the people around you. And I just love it when leftists will occasionally pop up on Facebook, like say a friend of mine will share an article of mine on their Facebook wall, and I'll see their leftist cat lady aunt start commenting on it and going after my friend, going after me. And then I will sometimes engage in, you know, conversation with them, and they get really censorious, and they just think that, you know, people like me shouldn't be around. And I say, you know, I understand completely. Basically, what you're saying is that you want to be surrounded by people who are like you. You're more comfortable around people who are like you, and you're very uncomfortable to encounter people with different opinions. And that's exactly how I feel. And that's a universal thing. And we simply want to be real about that and give people the opportunity to gather around people who are like them. And oh God, that's so triggering, because you know, you don't want to back somebody into a corner and show that really their own premises are leading to my kinds of conclusions. But it's true. A lot of these people really don't want diversity themselves. They want their own kind of uniformity. And so that means they want to eject people like me from their space. But they just won't extend the courtesy to, me and grant that there's any legitimacy for my desires.
Yeah, I've also experienced that in various ways in real life, where people had the experience at school when people came across a bunch of my writing interviews, and there's a groups of people who no longer wanted to sit next to me in classes. And I thought, oh, okay, that's cool. Like, they want to move on the other side of the room because they want to be like people like themselves. But that's, you know, that's the entire premise of everything I'm saying too. It just falls along. It just happens that it falls a little more on racial lines, and they want to say it's, racist, everything's racist and whatnot. And that's a whole nother interesting topic about like what right, the illegitimacy of racism. And even if they are right, you can kind of accept it and be like, yeah, okay, I guess it's whatever, it might be racist, but so what?
Right. One thing I want to talk about is this claim that online shopping has destroyed malls. I do not think that that's true. And you point out counterexamples to that. For me, what drives people towards online shopping is diversity, which also destroys malls. So when you live in a society that's increasingly diverse, you want to spend less time in public. And therefore, you find yourself more and more inclined to just order things and have them delivered. So it's not online shopping that's causing malls to perish. It's diversity causing malls to perish. And when you go to a city like New York, for instance, so many people are so overloaded with diversity and tension and crowds and things like that, that at the end of the workday, they want to go home and they don't want to go out again. I've had the worst trouble when I lived in New York just seeing my friends socially because they didn't want to go out because it was just too diverse and too stressful to go anywhere. And so you'd literally be 6 miles from a friend as the crow flies or less, and you wouldn't see them for months on end. And these are really good friends. And a lot of times people would get home and they would just want to have their groceries delivered or food delivered, whatever. They wouldn't want to go out again. So all these like Uber Eats services and things like that, where people are delivering food to you, all of that's been driven, is being driven by diversity. It's being driven by alienation, basically. And when you don't have that alienation, you find that people flock to public spaces. But they don't want to make explicit what's going on there and what's attracting them to these public spaces.
Yeah, I agree entirely with all of that. The people saying it's online shopping, that's killed. I think, like you just said, they kind of have the causal effect backwards. And online shopping has, of course, would be a thing, and would encroach on brick and mortar retail sales, and things would change. But the idea of needing, you know, meeting friends, online shopping doesn't change your desire to want to meet friends. And if you want to meet friends at the public space, like I said, the malls are the new public space. And it's a town square essentially. And I've also seen, you know, the detractors who will say it's online shopping also often say that the malls are a kind of modernity symbol of materialism and should be like destroyed anyway. And I think they miss a lot of historical points. One being that the idea of an enclosed town square is very old. There was, you know, there's French arcades and Italian loggias that often have, they would have different galleries and bazaars and sometimes multi-level. And there are some of these, if you look at classic arcades and these like enclosed town squares, you know, they're all over Europe and French and France and Italy. There's gallerias that are hundreds of years old that are essentially just enclosed town squares. And one in Milan, that's literally what it is, an enclosed town square.
Mm-hmm. Well, these go back to antiquity, really.
Oh, yeah, they even go back to antiquity, too, sure. Yeah, you would have had the idea of an enclosed town square in Athens and Rome. And when you think about different places geographically in European history, you know, an outdoor town square might be really great in a place along the Mediterranean where you always have nice temperate weather. But if you're further north or place that you get a lot of precipitation and weather, you know, they just would have been enclosed and it would have been the same thing. There would have been restaurants, there would have been promenades, fountains, mm-hmm. benches, all of the same stuff that malls recreated maybe in suburbia would have been around for as long as we've been putting civilizations together as European people. And it might have, you know, your cobbler might have been replaced by a footlocker, and you get some trappings of modern life, of course. But it's the basic idea of a place to go meet and eat and be entertained and play games, you know, skill games is like the arcade. The whole thing has been around for thousands of years. And I don't think online shopping could change that, because online shopping doesn't change the fact that, like you said, you have a friend a few miles away that you want to meet. Well, where do you meet? Let's meet in the town square. Okay, let's meet somewhere where we can get lunch, we can sit, we can people watch, we can read, we can be entertained, we can pick up maybe some food for later, for some snacks, you know, you needed a new whatever bed sheets, pick up something while you're there. It's this kind of one-stop shop town square.
In the Mediterranean world, of course, it's really, really sunny. And so people would want to cover over things for shade. And so you had the stoas, which were porches. There were columned. You know, they were open on one side to the elements, but they had a roof over them. And so there was shade. And along these, there would be shops. So it's not too far from the mall. These were public spaces. Some of them were spaces where there were municipal offices and things like that, but others had commercial enterprises attached to them. Yeah, one of the things that I think did contribute to the decline of, say, the bookstore cafe type thing is people like going to these places. Definitely, they enjoyed that, but there was a tendency for them to go to Borders when Borders still existed, or Barnes & Noble today. And they'd see a book, and they'd jot it down, and they'd go home, and they'd order it for less on Amazon, right? And, of course, they didn't mean to destroy Borders that way, but they ended up destroying Borders that way. So it was a kind of tragedy of the commons where, basically, people were enjoying a public space, a space where they could encounter things in the real world. And instead of paying the rent to keep that up, you know, they allowed Amazon.com to drive these things out of business, and then they felt, well, deprived. They felt sad that they didn't have their Borders stores anymore. So that is a problem. It's a problem when a for-profit business provides, in effect, a public good. And the public good isn't really monetizable, and they can be driven out of business by the online retailer. But the fact is that I think one of the great things that drives people out of the public spaces to just do online retailing is that they just don't want to deal with the hassle of diversity. Diversity and also crowding. Cities are more crowded. Traffic takes longer to commute, stuff like that. So the decay of our urban life, our public life, and diversity is a huge problem there, I think is driving people into the private world. And that means staying at home and getting a package every damn day from Amazon.com, which is the truth about a lot of people I know now.
Yeah, you really do see that. And yeah, there's definitely some instances, Borders being a good example of, you know, online shopping hurting them a lot. It just, I just see it as it kind of changes the face of things. But you can't online shop a coffee shop with a view and all the other things that would have gone on at the town square or the mall.
Yeah, basically what people did for a long time is they were free riders. They'd go to Borders, have a cup of coffee, meet people. They'd have some new experience that wasn't planned. They'd enjoy that whole thing. They'd see a book. They'd write down the title. And then they'd get it from Amazon and, in effect, be a free rider on the IRL experience that they were enjoying. And the trouble is that enough people free rode until they rode the thing into the ground, basically. They made it economically unviable, and it's gone. You know, Amazon.com, I think, has 71% of the world's book business. And I believe Barnes & Noble, which is still hanging on, has 8%, and they're number two. So between those two companies, you've got 80%, basically, of the world's book business. But Barnes & Noble gives you something that, and they've got their .com, too, but when people think about Barnes & Noble, they think of a bookstore, a physical bookstore. That you want to hang out at, and I hope that they can hang on. I do think that's good. Since I have been deplatformed to the tune of 17 of my titles, including books that I personally authored by Amazon.com, I have reversed the way that people free ride. I used to be one of these people who would be in a used bookstore, and I'd see a title, and I'd say, ah, that's interesting. I'd take a photo of it with my phone, go home, see if I could find it new or used more cheaply, basically, at Amazon, and I'd order it. So I was free riding off these book and brick-and-mortar stores. Now what I do is I use Amazon's algorithms to learn about new books, and then I buy them from brick-and-mortar stores because I don't... And I want to pay the extra now. I'm going to pay the extra because I want to resist Amazon they don't love me anymore, so I don't love them anymore.
I like it. It's a good way to go back at them.
Yeah, exactly. So there have been a lot of legal changes, and I know that law is your area. There have been a lot of legal changes and a lot of cultural changes that have driven the emptying out of public spaces, the destruction of comfortable environments that white people used to take for granted as public goods. Do you want to talk a bit about that? Because I think that's a fascinating part of the war against white people, which is a theme that you've been writing on.
Yeah, in regards to kind of the malls and suburbia and 7-Eleven, there's a couple things that are landmark, and I think they're wrongly decided. And one of the things is a 1948 Supreme Court case called Shelley versus Kramer, and it's it challenged the idea of a racially restrictive covenant in a neighborhood. So it used to be, if you and I were neighbors, we could agree in a covenant and put it in our deeds that neither one of us were allowed to sell our homes or transfer them to anybody but white people. And what that would do is it would ensure if one of us moved out, we would keep white neighbors and keep a white neighborhood. And if you left your home to your kids and, you know, you wanted your kids to stay and grow up in a white neighborhood and your grandkids to grow up in a white neighborhood and white school, you could ensure that. And entire neighborhoods would have these agreements with each other. So this was challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court, kind of went back and forth a couple times when a black family wanted to move into a house in a white neighborhood. And their lawyers and the people who were lobbying to have this changed were almost entirely Jewish people. The Solicitor General at the time wrote a brief that was written entirely by Jews, and there's internal memos. I think it, to a certain point, if you go to the Shelley versus Kramer Wikipedia page, this was even actually on Wiki. I don't know if it still is, because I think some things about Jewish subversion are being removed from Wiki. But I have the original brief that I'm going to like link and we'll publish when I put this stuff on Countercurrents and in the book. But in this internal memo, the guys writing it were Jews. The Solicitor General was a Jew who was filing this brief with the Supreme Court trying to get things changed. So this is from very high up in the U.S. government, that Jews in influential legal positions wanted to get rid of these racially restrictive covenants, because a lot of times they also named Jews. They would say nobody of the Semitic or Negroid or Asiatic races could live in here, only Caucasians or only whites, depending on how it was worded. But in this Solicitor General brief that a bunch of Jews wrote, it actually tells the people that were writing it, that from the Solicitor General, to remove your names, because I don't want it to look like four Jews were behind this. And it was just shocking the first time I read it. I'm reading this case in, first year of law school. And, there's a reference to the Solicitor General brief. And I go and get on Westlaw and look at it. And I just couldn't believe what I was reading. That in 1948, they were saying, the Solicitor General was saying, I'm a Jew, you're all Jews. Let's make sure we remove our names so people don't see four Jew names and know what's really going on here. That it was basically Jews that are destroying white neighborhoods, not this black person suing. So it was just kind of a tremendous red pill, I guess. I mean, I was already I had already been writing and already pretty far down the road, but it was just another like, oh my gosh, this subversion is deep and been going on for a long time. So the result of that case was that racially restrictive covenants were now illegal and unenforceable. And it was a very shaky decision in legal reasoning. They said that because you had a willing buyer and a willing seller, in order to interpret it, it was essentially the government interpreting something negatively against another race and then runs afoul of equal protection clauses. And it was just a very bizarre, kind of ham-fisted legal decision that doesn't make much sense, because anytime the government has to interpret a contract, they are what they're saying, Shelley versus Kramer, is that the government becomes a government like actor, and now it's the government racially enforcing something that runs afoul of equal protection. And if that's true, then any time the government interprets any contract in a dispute, they're then becoming a government actor, is what they're saying, which just doesn't hold true in any other area of the law, of contract law. So it's just a very bizarre decision. And from reading the Solicitor's General brief, you can see that they were just going to get it passed no matter what, under any excuse. So that's what eroded being able to have your white neighborhoods and keeping only white people there. Then 20 years later, in 1968, Emanuel Seller, of the Immigration Act fame, introduced an amendment to the Civil Rights Act, which was the Fair Housing Act, that then made that decision black letter law. So made it federal law that you can't have racially restricted covenants, and then added all the other language about housing discrimination. So up until that point, the 48 and then 68, you could, through private covenants, make your own white neighborhood, make your own little white utopia. And you could, have your corner stores and your malls, and you could keep anybody out that you didn't like. You could keep non-whites out. And you didn't see people having to move every 20 years to a better school district as the slow march of diversity encroached upon them and their neighborhood and their children's schools. So that's one strain. That was kind of the impetus of white flight. That's really where it started in 48, when you couldn't keep blacks out of your neighborhood anymore. So then you really started to see things, people moving further away from the city and in the suburbs. The other issue around the same time was the Civil Rights Act, which was authorized based on the Commerce Clause. And what that did was tell private businesses. Before this, there was this big issue of like private actors and government actors, where they would say, okay, the government can't discriminate because of equal protection, but private actors can discriminate because they're not subject to the 14th Amendment. But so that was a big legal problem that the people who wanted to destroy white society had to work around. And just like they did in Shelley versus Kramer, they essentially made up a thing. And the thing they made up was that it's in the economic interest of the country to not restrict black people from establishments that are privately owned. So there was these little places. There's the Ollie's Barbecue case, the Heart of Atlanta Motel case, where these little family-owned businesses wanted to keep it whites only, and the government told them they can't do that. And they did that through a kind of this really ham-fisted, again, unjust Commerce Clause justification of saying, well, it affects business and it's good for the total economy. And the real irony of that is that when places are now opened up to blacks, they go out of business. I've seen it time and time again where neighborhoods, one of my favorite pizza places was in business for 60 years. When the neighborhood turned black, they kept getting robbed. The owner got shot at the last robbery and he finally closed it up. So the whole justification is that the reason you have to let blacks into your mall and movie theater and restaurant and hotels is because it'll help commerce. But then as soon as you let them in, white people don't want to go there and it hurts the business. So all these things need to be revisited.
Yeah. I mean, for one thing, yeah, you're right. It's not even true just in terms of the commercial justification. But beyond that, there should be other criteria besides commercial. Right, we could have a high GDP and have an unlivable society. In fact, that's what we've got for a lot of people now. So it should be an irrelevant consideration, really. And one of the things about identity politics that's rising and is very disturbing to the conservative right, there's a new piece in The Economist about this that I swear it was written by a machine. I guess it was probably written by a bunch of people in a committee, but it has a strange quality to it. But anyway, they're just so scared now that their economic arguments don't cut water. They don't hold any weight now. So, for instance, they predicted that Brexit would bring economic ruin and biblical plagues. And 6 out of 10 Britons said, even if we believe that's true, 6 out of 10 Brexit voters said, even if we believe that it's going to harm the economy, we still want our sovereignty back. And that kind of preference terrifies these people because that's all they've got anymore, right? Is all their Koch brothers' talking points. That's all they've got. None of the other stuff really has any purchase on people. And once that economism, uber alles attitude, is no longer has any weight, these people are just dead. National Review is dead. You know, that Chamber of Commerce republicanism is dead once identity trumps GDP.
Yeah, that is really true, and it's a real problem. A lot of people need to kind of, they've been sort of, I don't know if they've been brainwashed or what the deal is, or maybe they're just, you know, greedy shysters. There's a lot of people who believe this line of thought, and and you can prove it's not true that these brown hordes are very inefficient GDP cogs. They bring down GDP per capita, even though they raise it in the aggregate. But yeah, the issue with those civil rights acts, and especially the 65 one that was based on economics, it really runs afoul of freedom of association, for one. And two, even if they were right and it having blacks in your business did help your business, and even if you ignored the freedom of association right that you have, it still doesn't really justify it, because you could still say, okay, what if it does help? And I still don't want the business. I want, you know, I'd rather have less money, but all white people here because it's safer. And none of that is ever considered. The social capital, the safety, nothing is, you know, just not how much money do we spend having to move every few years to get away from these people? It's tremendous. And none of that ever makes it into the conversation. And I really hope it starts to. I kind of talk about a lot on Twitter that when people argue about these different foodstuffs, and I said, I'd rather eat 50-year-old canned sauerkraut and never have to see another Somalian for the rest of my life. You know, I'm really hoping people that kind of thinking catches on, this racial awareness that you're better off with less material wealth among your own people than being a really rich person in Nigeria or something like that.
One of the things that really drove bad architecture and bad urban planning is just economism. And I really do think that that's one of the things that made modern architecture take off, right? It was an ideology that allowed people to, you know, make buildings with lower ceilings and more floors, with less ornamentation, out of uglier materials. And, you know, the architect's drawings look clean and neat and everything, but the buildings look atrocious and ugly. And you know, the people were driven to that by the bottom line, or at least they accepted that because of bottom line concerns. But there were a lot of ideological forces at work in pushing modern architecture. And I wonder if you can comment on some of those. I know you've been doing some research on that.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things around modern architecture. You see kind of an early movement, the Bauhaus movement, that was came about during the Weimar period of Germany. And you see there was a German guy, Walter Gropius, who was kind of the head of the Bauhaus architecture. And a lot of this was a total rejection of tradition and of the sort of vernacular building style of being able to go to a place, some city in Europe, and knowing where you were by the architecture, kind of local materials, with the local style. And this led, this vernacular style led to a lot of very unique and beautiful places. And Bauhaus started as very much a rejection of all of this. And it kind of is kind of, they turned their back on the ornamentation that you would see. They turned their back on anything other than sort of the bare minimum. And you see this in the materials. They use a lot of steel, a lot of unfinished concrete, a lot of commercial glass plates. And this Bauhaus movement kind of gave rise to the international style, which is the big glass boxes you see, big glass rectangular boxes. When the National Socialists came to power, they actually exiled all these Bauhaus people. They were one of the groups like the Frankfurt School and like the Magnus Hirschfeld's Institute for Sex Research. They were another organization that was seen as very subversive and kicked out of Germany. A lot of these people from Bauhaus ended up in Tel Aviv in the U.S. And there's a whole place in Tel Aviv that has about 4,000 buildings called the White City, where you see a lot of this international Bauhaus style architecture. So you had people who were, you had people that were ideologically socialist. A lot of them were ethnically Jews, and they had, for whatever reason, some had different personal reasons. One of the theories about Gropius in particular is that a woman that he was in love with cheated on him in a cozy Aspen chalet that was very traditional architecture of Germany, and so he hated this idea of traditional architecture because it reminded him of being cheated on in this place where he was betrayed. And some of the things I read, they said that Gropius particularly liked this idea of a glass box because it was transparent and you could see everything, and it was kind of the antithesis of where he was betrayed. And there's just all sorts of interesting stories about these people from early on in their like sexual proclivities to them being exiled out of Germany and them going on to kind of proliferate this architecture style throughout the world. So from there, you see the internationalist movement kind of spread. And then a little bit later, you get the brutalist and deconstruction movement that came from some of these students of Bauhaus. And, or, you know, if you get really into the literature, there are people who say, like, deconstructionism isn't modern, it's postmodern because it's a reaction to brutalism or, you know, whatever. It's some kind of art snobs will get into those sort of topics. It's really just all degenerate and heavily Jewish architecture is what you see. And it's one of the themes I've noticed, that they are people who are kind of, you know, the 20th century phrase of being rootless cosmopolitans. A lot of them are rootless people who traveled around a lot and moved to different places, and they design architecture in a way that reflects that. They are these very stark lines, a lot of concrete, a lot of vertically placed windows, stuff that looks out of place really everywhere and doesn't fit into anywhere. It looks very alien and dystopian, something like you might see on some alien planet almost, how different it is. I was just recently came across quite a few buildings that were done in the brutalist structure, and they had these huge concrete overhangs and these thin vertically aligned windows that almost look like a prison, and a couple of them were government buildings, and they just send this like really imposing message that's incredibly uncomfortable and unwelcoming, and it affects people. There's even some body of research out there that I've gotten into that I'm going to mention in the article about how people actually feel differently psychologically in different built environments. And there's one article that said that the international style and brutalist style architecture actually gives people headaches to look at. So I'm kind of including, we'll weave all that into the article. But really what you see is a sort of minimalist approach that turns its back on tradition and beauty. The philosophy of Bauhaus was that beauty was excessive and bourgeoisie, like a bourgeoisie quality, and like in any ornamentation was unnecessary, and they couldn't understand why people would want like a Beaux-Arts ornamentation or like, you know, any Federalist style embellishment anywhere. It was totally foreign to them what we see as tradition. And that's really kind of an underlying theme in all of these architectural styles that emerge either through Bauhaus or as kind of like late latter day, either reactions to it or their students of students, all down this line of modern architecture.
Yeah, it strikes me that a lot of this stuff is premised on radical alienation. And it's not just cultural alienation, but it's almost like alienation even from the material realm. Because, well, there's nothing more material than buildings, right? But you can still have a kind of building style that's immaterial or anti-material or simply by making things ugly. By making things ugly, utilitarian, and drab, you're basically signaling alienation from the material world. And that is a very Judaic mentality. For instance, if you look at radical Judaizing forms of Protestantism, what is the one thing that they have in common? It's an attack on, say, beautiful architecture and adornment for churches as pagan, right? And of course, you know, some elegance will creep back in over time, but the tendency of Protestantism of the more Calvinistic and Judaically inspired kind is against material beauty. It's a kind of Gnostic attitude towards the material world. And you combine that with this attitude of perpetual exile, right? Jews are not in their homelands when they're in the West. And so what kind of architecture would be characteristic of that or expressive of that? Well, it'd be something that doesn't belong, that's not organically connected to the traditions of whatever society they're in. It just seems like it is very much connected with a kind of Old Testament mentality, a mentality that treats icons as evil, right? The prohibition against graven images. A mentality of people who are nomadic at root rather than city dwellers. And a kind of, if you will, anti-materialist materialism. And anti-materialist materialism really boils down to a worship of the ugly, uglying up the landscape with, you know, brutalist architecture.
Yeah, that you really do see that to the point where it seems like anti-beauty is almost the goal. I've recently was traveling a bit and saw several works of Daniel Lipskind, a Jewish architect, whose architecture has won all kinds of awards, and he just gets contracts internationally. And what he does, it's a deconstruction style. And he'll take these classic buildings all over the world. There's the Royal Ontario Museum in Canada. There's a military history museum in Berlin. There was a Jesse Street substation in San Francisco that I think is a Jewish museum now. There's a building he did in Berlin. And what he does is he takes these traditional these buildings who have survived hundreds of years, oftentimes survived wars, oftentimes, and he adds these very ugly, foreign, alien-looking apparatuses to them. It looks like a crystal was exploding out of the inside and then frozen there. You could pull up, you know, any of Daniel Lipskind's work, and you see it, and these buildings are oftentimes gray and ugly and look like they've been like had these scars in them, and they're just horrific. And you see them in places that have cultural significance to European people. And there's a couple other Jewish architects that do this, and I don't know that a lot of people have noticed it, because I don't know that a lot of like architecture critics are concerned with, like, you know, the Jewish question or anything like that. I've not really seen too much about it in all the literature I've reviewed, but what a couple of these people have made careers doing is defiling traditional European architecture and traditional buildings that have been around for some, like I said, sometimes hundreds of years. And it's very jarring. I remember seeing a few of these in person, some, like I said, recently, and some many years ago when I was younger. And the one in Toronto particularly, I turned the corner and was like, it was jarring. I kind of stopped in the middle of my tracks to look at this building and couldn't figure out what the hell I was looking at. And I knew, like, you know, I saw this traditional yellow brick and it was beautiful. Then there was like this glass and steel structure piercing through it. And it was just the most bizarre and unnerving feeling. And I remember thinking that it reminded me, like at the time, it felt like some alien life form had like conquered this town and this was their mark. And,
well, that's really kind of true, isn't it?
Yeah. And then later on, you know, this was like real early 20s, and later on in life, some years later, since I saw this, I thought, wow, that's exactly what it is. And so some of those discussions will be in this article. There'll be a ton of pictures of explaining everything I'm talking about. But yeah, you see, I think it's more, there's the rootless cosmopolitan aspect of how would a people with no homeland and no connection to the society build to make themselves feel at home. And as an international and rootless people, these are sort of like these international style or outpost where they can maybe go to New York City and San Francisco and Shanghai and Tel Aviv and all over the world and say, oh, okay, yeah, my people are here. This is safe. And then there's also the aspect of it of like wanting to really punish a people and show them that they're occupied. And I think that is where a lot of the deconstruction stuff comes into play and some of the brutalist stuff. And that'll kind of all be fleshed out in the article I'll have up pretty soon.
I know there are going to be a lot of people clamoring to find out, okay, when's he going to start publishing this stuff? So I think this has been a really good discussion, and I'm really looking forward to, you know, seeing more about this and, you know, continuing the conversation maybe another time.
Yeah, that'd be great. After we get, maybe after we do the architecture piece and the mall rat piece, we'll kind of talk a little bit about the like follow-ups on those once they're out for a little bit.
We'll definitely have you back on another episode of Countercurrents Radio.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.